From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in today for Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Supreme Court has handed down a couple of doozies today. One question on gerrymandering and another decision on the census. We'll find out how they both affect Michigan.
The onus is on us now as Michiganders to make this and ensure this independent commission is a success and is truly fair and impartial.
And if so many Michiganders support protections for gay rights, why don't lawmakers?
The other problem I think this issue has, even though it's widely supported along the electorate, is it's not a powerful motivator.
Is the auto industry due for an economic downturn? Or is this just the normal cycle of business? We'll speak with Daniel Howes. Plus, breaking news over Enbridge's Line 5 oil pipeline. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. Big news from the U.S. Supreme Court today. The High Court says federal courts should stay out of disputes over partisan gerrymandering. A federal court earlier had ordered Michigan lawmakers to redraw dozens of district lines in the state for the 2020 election. Jocelyn Benson is Michigan Secretary of State. Your reaction to the news just out?
Well, it's a crazy day for democracy. I mean, it's challenging because the courts have traditionally played a role of guardians of our democratic rights. And for the court today to simply close the door to even hearing any arguments that citizens' rights have been infringed is really disappointing and goes against really, you know, the entire history of our Constitution in our modern democracy.
What were the reasons that the court gave?
Well, in deciding that citizens can no longer bring any challenges at all to partisan gerrymandering or the use of drawing district lines to help one party or hurt another, the court said two things, essentially. One, we've never really been able to find a standard that is sort of meets an unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering, which is, you know, the opposite of what several district courts or lower courts actually said. They actually had found a standard. And then in light of that, the Supreme Court said, this is just not the role of the courts. It's a political question. It's not the role of the courts to get involved, when for the past 50 years, they have been. Ever since the dawn of gerrymandering in this modern era, the courts and the Constitution have played a role in protecting citizens' rights. It's a sharp U-turn away from protecting citizens. And for that reason, it's disappointing.
So maps will not be redrawn for 2020, but redistricting new maps under the new system, an independent commission that voters adopted in 2018, will still go forward.
So this thankfully does give us clarity on the 2020 elections, which I am very happy about in that regard with this particular case. But it also, the court did give a nod to independent redistricting commissions as a vehicle for which citizens can ensure their rights are protected. And so I'm really proud that Michigan is now at the forefront of drawing districts the way they should be, fair, impartial, with a mind towards what's best for citizens, not politicians. And so in that regard, the onus is on us now as Michiganders to make this and ensure this independent commission is a success and is truly fair and impartial. And citizens can go already to our website, redistrictingmichigan.org, if they want to see more about the process itself. But that citizen district commission will be convened in the fall of 2020 and will work over the course of the following year to have new maps in place for every election following 2021 and beyond in that decade.
So as of today, are Michigan voters protected from partisan gerrymandering?
We are more protected from partisan gerrymandering than we were a year ago when politicians were drawing our district lines that resulted in maps that our U.S. District Court at the local level said were unconstitutional. Now citizens draw our districts in Michigan. We're one of a handful of states that has a truly fair and impartial process. And it will only work if we will only see true fair and impartial districts if citizens with well-intention and good faith get involved, serve on the commission, testify before the commission. And so I'm excited. I think the onus is on us as citizens to embrace this new era of districting. We now no longer have the protection, at least in this scenario, with partisan gerrymandering from the Supreme Court. But we do have the power to draw our own districts in Michigan, and citizens now can embrace that power and make sure we've got fair districts moving forward.
Jocelyn Benson, Michigan's Secretary of State, and I should note, a former dean of the law school at Wayne State and a Supreme Court watcher indeed.
Yes, very much so, particularly around election law issues.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court has also ruled today that President Donald Trump's administration cannot add a citizenship question to the 2020 census, for now, at least. The court says the administration's explanation for wanting to add the question was, quote, more of a distraction than an explanation. Kurt Metzger is an expert demographer and mayor of Pleasant Ridge, and we turn to him for an explanation of what is going on here. Hey, Kurt.
Hi, Zoe. How are you?
Good. So you understand the census like the back of your hand. What does this ruling mean for Michigan?
It's an important ruling for the country as a whole, because this has been a ploy by the Trump administration to identify non-citizens. All the explanations, there have been lie after lie after lie coming out of Wilbur Ross. It was his decision that the DOJ came to him and said, we need this question for supporting the Voting Rights Act. That is not true. The census has not asked a question on the census since 1950 in terms of citizenship. And then a couple weeks ago, we found this hard drive with a number of emails from a gerrymandering specialist, a redistricting specialist, who in the emails said very clearly that the idea was if they could depress the Latino vote, they could increase the number of Republican drawn seats and continue to increase Republican majorities in legislatures.
So help us understand the part of the ruling that basically, again, was the for now.
The thought was, or at least the idea was, that they were going to rule 5-4. In favor of including the census question. Mm-hmm. And this goes against district rulings and appeals court rulings coming forward. But then when this information came out from the deceased redistricting specialist, when his estranged daughter found the hard drive and other information, all of a sudden that went back to the appeals court, pushed it back down to the district court in Maryland. And they said, we need to investigate this further and look into this new evidence that had come to light. They wanted to look at this in relationship to their previous decision, which was to not include the citizenship question. So now the Supreme Court has come and more or less taken that into consideration. Justice Roberts has more or less come out on the side of the liberal side of things, mm-hmm. and against inclusion for now. And has said we need to study this more.
So what should we be watching for next?
So now we have this question about the possibility of pushing the Census Bureau back in terms of printing while this decision goes on. But until the Census Bureau starts to print questionnaires, there's still that question. And I don't know. I think we're at a point that this marks the end of it. Any new evidence that would come forth would show how much of a bogus idea this was and how it was really a trick to undermine the Latino count and to preserve Republican majorities.
Kurt Metzger, demographer and mayor of Pleasant Ridge, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And if the two big Supreme Court decisions weren't enough for a summer day of newsmaking, let's turn to Jonathan Oesting, reporter at the Detroit News, with headlines from Attorney General Dana Nessel, who today announced she's taking legal action to try and shut down Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline in the Great Lakes. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Zoe, how are you?
Good. So let's take a listen to what Nessel had to say just a few hours ago.
I wanted to provide Governor Whitmer with the time she needed to attempt to reach an agreement which would get the pipelines out of the straits on an expedited basis. She tried her best, but Enbridge walked away from negotiations and instead filed a lawsuit against the state of Michigan. Once that occurred, there was no need for further delay.
No need for further delay. Jonathan, what's going on here?
Well, I think a lot of us saw this coming. Of course, the Attorney General campaigned on a pledge to shut down Line 5. But as mentioned, the Governor Whitmer, was attempting to renegotiate a tunnel deal to keep Line 5 operating in a way through a new tunnel. But the Attorney General, you know, as you mentioned, thought that process had gone on too long. And she went ahead and filed a lawsuit today. Interestingly, in Ingham County Court, she probably could have chosen any venue in the state, but perhaps she thinks that might be a more friendly one to her argument.
So what happens next here, legally speaking?
Well, I mean, the fear from both sides, the governor and Bridge, has been all along that an attempt to shut down Line 5 might lead to a very protracted legal battle. I mean, there's the concern, of course, with the tunnel was that it would take 5 to 10 years maybe to construct. But there have been some who have said that a legal battle might take even longer. Enbridge hasn't, you know, formally responded in court yet, and they actually didn't say too much about the filing today other than that they're reviewing it. But the CEO of the company told me last week that if the state did move to shut down Line 5, they would, of course, have to vigorously defend it. In a statement today about the move, they did say they intend to continue operating Line 5 for decades to come, with a plural there, decades. So clearly, this is going to be a fight, and I don't know how it's going to play out in court.
And so that's the court action. Do we think that there's any reason to believe that Governor Whitmer and the energy giant are continuing their own conversations about coming up with a deal still?
It doesn't sound like it. As late as late last week, the Enbridge CEO did talk to me and some other reporters and sort of make a public plea to return to the negotiating table with the governor. But they are pretty far apart. I mean, the governor wanted a plan to get Line 5 out of the water within 2 years if they were going to move ahead with the tunnel. Enbridge says that's just not possible. And in fact, they refused to even agree to any sort of date certain to get Line 5 out at any point, you know, basically saying they can't control permitting and other things that might impact the timeline for constructing that tunnel. So they were pretty far apart. We know that the governor had tried to negotiate, and there was some speculation over whether her and Nestle were on the same page. Well, clearly they are, because today, as soon as Nestle filed this lawsuit, the governor also directed the Department of Natural Resources to commence a study of its compliance with the easement that allows Line 5 to run on the bottom of the Mackinac Strait. So clearly they're working in concert here, and they've given up on the negotiations, at least at this point.
Jonathan Osting, Detroit News reporter all-star, thanks so much.
Thanks, Zoe.
Still to come, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Inn riots, the ignition to the gay rights movement. How did that impact the LGBT community in Michigan? We'll find out in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark. A profit desert is coming, or so says a new report that Detroit business columnist Daniel Howes has been digging into. Hey, Daniel.
Hey.
So a profit desert for the auto industry. I thought times were good. What's going on here?
Well, they are good comparatively, but they're getting perceptibly worse and more difficult as we go forward every month. And I think this has some real implications going forward. Look, the auto industry, we've talked about it many times on this show, I've written about it a lot, is really two auto industries right now. It's the traditional make cars, trucks, SUVs, develop those products, occasionally dabble in putting out electric cars that very few people buy, comparatively speaking. And then there's the whole new world of new technology. And having to fund that new technology is absorbing more and more cash in enormous amounts. One of the predictions in this report by Alex Partners is that within the next 4 or 5 years, the auto industry is going to put $225 billion into the development of electric vehicles. Now, you look at that and you say, well, where are all the people to buy these vehicles? And I think that's one of the big questions. But this has major ramifications. I mean, UAW members, for example, who have been accustomed to really nice profit-sharing checks over the last 7, 8 years, this could have implications for that.
But you do talk in your column that, in fact, the auto industry, of course, is a cyclical business, that adjustments and realignments happen throughout history. So isn't that just kind of what's going on here?
Yine. Not really. I mean, It is, in the sense that, you know, we're coming off the greatest expansion of sales and profitability in the last 50 years. Coming out of the Great Recession, every year sales were expanding in the United States, profits were going up. So we've been accustomed to those kinds of things. What's different today is the cyclicality is complicated by the auto 2.0 thing that's hanging out there. The industry is now competing with Silicon Valley, with tech giants, with very innovative companies that move a lot faster than auto companies historically have. Now, how that race ends up, we don't know. But I think the point of this report and why I thought it was important to write about it is we don't know how long this desert is. You know, is this a small desert that they're going to get across in a couple, 3 years? Or is it something that's going to last a lot longer because companies, for example, a General Motors decides, we're going to go it alone. We're going to partner as little as possible. We'll make a few acquisitions. We're going to develop a lot of our technology in-house. Or another company, say a Fiat Chrysler, that says, we want to partner with people. We don't have certain expertise, and we're men enough and women enough to admit it, that we don't have certain expertise, that we can go out and buy it in the marketplace or partner with it in the marketplace. So how these companies decide to negotiate this thicket going forward or this desert really will depend on how long it takes for them to get across that desert.
Well, so who decides? Like, who is making those decisions right now? I mean, like, does the auto industry, obviously, they must employ economists. What, you know, there's this new industry futurists. I mean, who gets to make these decisions?
Well, ultimately, the top leadership does. And I think that's why it's important to look at how the leaders are positioning the companies, the decisions that they're taking in terms of who they're partnering with. I'll give you a good example. General Motors goes out and acquires a company called Cruise Automation out in San Francisco, and that's going to be the brains of its autonomous vehicles going forward. Fiat Chrysler says, we're not doing that. So we're going to make vehicles and we're going to partner with Waymo, which is affiliated with Google, which has probably got more miles of AV testing under its belt than any other company in the world at this stage of the game. So who's smarter? FCA has taken a position that, you know, we cannot out-tech tech. We can integrate technologies into the vehicle, but we can't out-tech tech. And that's the way we're going to do things.
So, I mean, are eventually auto companies just going to become tech companies?
I think in a lot of ways they already have. I mean, that's the direction they're going. You know, they are the great integrators. And I think if we had had this conversation a couple, 3 years ago, people would have said, you know, this race is already over. Silicon Valley won. Detroit is dead. Fast forward now to today, the tech giants have come to the conclusion that building cars, ask Elon Musk, is not easy. And integrating technology, doing it economically, doing it with precision. I mean, that's what building vehicles is all about. You do the same thing every time, and it looks the same every time. And other companies have found that's really hard to do, and the margins are crappy compared to the tech world. So I think there's a different appreciation now on both sides. Auto industry has realized there are certain things they just don't have the capability to do, and they need to go out and find that capability and partner with it or acquire it or both. And the tech companies have come to the same conclusions that, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to need the traditional auto industry to get their technology in and to actually scale the business that they envision.
A brave new world. Daniel Howes, business columnist for the Detroit News, thanks so much.
You bet.
In her latest short story collection, Unblinking, Lisa Lenzo focuses on Detroit and a range of subjects, including race, class, disability, aging, and family. Lenzo grew up in Detroit and lives with her husband near Saugatuck. Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor has this review.
The stories in Lisa Lenzo's new collection are placed primarily, although not exclusively, in Detroit. It's a Detroit just before the recent gentrifications, and a city with vibrant friendships among neighbors, of people who take walks at night to get some air, who are cautious but unafraid. And these are often stories about caregivers, both the official ones who provide care for a living, but more often about those among us who take care of our neighbors and our families, because that is what people do. That is the demand of love. In the title story, Unblinking, an older white couple lives in a condo downtown. The husband, Ralph, is very frail and has slipped into the creeping dementia that sometimes comes with Parkinson's. His wife, Rosie, has decided she can take care of him on her own. She takes him out rather late one evening to go to the corner market, but the journey becomes epically difficult. Ralph begins to slip out of his wheelchair, and Rosie is too weak to get him back in. When he finally slips all the way out, Rosie is at a loss and begins to feel desperate. Four young black men, talking rough and swaggering down the street, rush over to help. They don't act like they've done anything heroic or even good. They've just done what they must do to help in the neighborhood. They walk the old couple back to their condo, remarking on the crescent moon rising over the city. It's hard to write about goodness. It seems that much in our history and our time conspires against the possibility of it. So many of us, otherwise well-intentioned readers, are skeptical of goodness. Yet Lisa Lenzo has found a way to write about it. Her sentences are clear and direct, unadorned. She lets action stand by itself without comment. She lets people act with their uncertainties, even their stupidities. But she understands the world as a place where people can do good things. They care, and their actions often show that care. I also suspect, although I'm partly guessing, that much of the world described in these stories is very close to the life Lisa Lenzo has lived and to the world she knows. Just a couple of internet searches let us know she was raised in Detroit and that she spent many years driving a bus in the Saugatuck-Douglas area on the west side of the state. It is one of the more interesting day jobs for a writer that I've heard about recently. One of my favorite stories in Unblinking, Lorelei, begins, "In the mornings, I write stories. In the afternoons, I drive for the public bus that provides door-to-door service in and around Saugatuck, Michigan. We carry the young and old, rich and poor, able-bodied and disabled, anyone who needs or wants a ride." That feels very close to reality, and might also be an explanation for the generosity of these short stories, for the care they give to the characters who live in them.
That was Keith Taylor with a review of Lisa Lenzo's latest collection of short stories, Unblinking. Lenzo will be reading from her book on July 8th at Literati in Ann Arbor. 50 years ago tomorrow, New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay club in Greenwich Village. That raid led to nights of rioting and really started the gay rights movement that moved across the country. Tim Retzloff is a professor at Michigan State University. He's almost done with his first book, Metro Gay, City, Suburb, and the Changing Map of Queer Detroit. He spoke with Cindy Canty about what the Stonewall riots meant for Michigan.
Tim, Stonewall really did become a catalyst for gay activism across the country, certainly here in Michigan. What was it like to be gay, lesbian, transgender, or questioning in Michigan before Stonewall?
Well, there was this long history of people living hidden lives, and kind of the options for being open were very narrow. So people could face losing their jobs, they could face incarceration if they were arrested on a homosexual charge.
Because of law,
illegal. Because there were laws on the books.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was, particularly after World War II, there was something called the Lavender Scare, which PBS has just aired a fabulous documentary about.
Which in a nutshell was?
Was the official policy of the federal government where one homosexual could contaminate an entire office. So under President Eisenhower, he issued an executive order. So, you know, people who wanted to maintain and give back to the federal government and work had to be quiet about their lives. And one accusation could mean the end of their job. And that kind of showed itself at the local and state level as well, so that, you know, there were certainly people who were part of everyday life. And as I continue to do research, I'm kind of amazed at how many people who I'm finding obituaries for who die, you know, in recent years have been together 50 some years. And so, you know, just the thought that, you know, they were able to maintain relationships all of that time.
But so when Stonewall happened, this was like a pot that had been simmering and simmering and simmering.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in terms of kind of gathering places, you know, for African Americans who were largely excluded from bars. They had rent parties and they found other venues. They had some bars in Detroit that were called sissy bars. But the bar scene in Detroit and in places like Ann Arbor and Flint and Grand Rapids was kind of under the radar for most people. And it was technically illegal to operate a bar that would be a rendezvous for homosexuals. Mm. And that was on the books till the late 70s, actually. But it really didn't stop bar operators from having these bars, in part because they had police payoffs, in part because, you know, by and large, these were straight owners. Mm. And I think the authorities understood that they didn't want to jeopardize their livelihood.
They didn't care about who they might have arrested.
Right.
So here you describe this closeted life for people that when the lid blew off that simmering pot with Stonewall, how quickly did activist groups like the Gay Liberation Front start forming in Michigan, and what cities saw the most activity?
Almost immediately in New York, the Gay Liberation Front started and some ancillary groups in the fall of 1969. So within months of the Stonewall riots in New York, word was getting out to the rest of the country. New York's the media capital of the country. So papers like the Village Voice and even the New York Times were reporting it. And then kind of the leftist underground newspaper network, the press, was getting word out as well.
Well, and it's worth mentioning when we're talking late 60s, early 70s, we're talking about tumultuous years for black rights, women's rights, the anti-war movement. So there was this strong counterculture voice that was there.
Absolutely. And I kind of like, you know, we talked about kind of this pent-up rage that was there. And I kind of see that as kind of the combustible material. But, you know, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the counterculture, the women's movement, the Black Power movement were kind of the oxygen that kind of provided the oxygen you need for something to explode and take off. So there's an activist who was involved in – he moved to Detroit from L.A. in part because of the radical labor movement there. He got a job in the shop and he placed an ad in the Fifth Estate.
Which was an underground paper?
Underground paper.
Published in Detroit. I remember it from my high school days. I do.
And he, you know, he initially it was a personal ad. And then shortly thereafter, you know, he just decided to start a gay group, see who would be interested. And Ann Arbor's own Jim Toy has this great story of typing up the church bulletin and seeing this notice for a gay group meeting at St. Joseph Episcopal Church. And he was like, what's a gay group?
Yes.
So he went to the minister and he called him Daddy-O. And he said, Daddy-O, what's this gay group? And he said, well, I don't know what it is, but if they can't meet here, we might as well close up shop.
So they met. That was the roots and the seed. And then it began to blossom. But at the same time that it was blossoming around Michigan, it's pretty clear there was racial and sexual inequality in those, especially in those early years. You write about West Michigan kind of being unique and having lesbian leadership, strong female participation, but that was the exception?
This was as part of this coalition that formed by late 71, early 72. And that's an area that kind of doing this additional research right now to try to understand gay liberation, I'm just discovering and kind of jumping ahead here. But there was kind of this moment where the women kind of put their foot down and said, you know,
hey,
enough sexism, not just in society, because they had in part come out through the feminist movement, but, you know, sexism within the gay movement. So And racism. So one of the things about the early formation and the early kind of shock waves of gay liberation was that these early meetings of the Gay Liberation Front were very mixed. You know, they had, you know, they were never majority female, they were always majority male, but they had, you know, a notable number of African Americans and people, other people of color, people that at the time would be called Chicano or Chicana. Mm-hmm. There were Native Americans involved. And, you know, they found that the oppression that they were feeling was being spoken about and not just based on their marginalization because of race and ethnicity, but, you know, because of sexuality and gender transgression. But kind of within the first year, there were divisions and there were people in the Gay Liberation Front who wanted to just tackle gay-only issues.
Mm-hmm. In our final minute, Tim, why does what happened at Stonewall 50 years ago matter to all of us?
Well, I think, you know, it sparked kind of this mass mobilization across the country. But the other thing that Stonewall did and kind of the embrace of kind of a new militants is gay liberation brought this idea that LGBTQ people needed to be visible. And that visibility, you know, which is sometimes problematic, not everyone can be out in their lives totally, but people used to come out within the gay world, and now they come out to everyone. And that means coworkers, neighbors, families. And so, you know, 1968, you might not feel you had an ally outside of the community at all. But I think now there's kind of this growing understanding. And at least one of our political parties has fully embraced LGBTQ rights and policy positions. And I think that's really important to understand.
Tim Retzlaff is a professor of history and LGBTQ studies at Michigan State and will soon be out with his first book, Metro Gay, City, Suburb, and the Changing Map of Queer Detroit. Pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Cindy.
Still to come, we will continue to talk gay rights and ask if so many Michiganders support protections for the LGBT community, why don't lawmakers? That's coming up on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark. In Michigan, you can be denied housing or a job for being gay. Plenty of folks in the state have pushed to end this, to do it by adding protection to the LGBT community in the state's Civil Rights Act. One Republican tried to do this 5 years ago. He was later defeated in a primary against a fellow Republican. His name is Frank Foster, and he's here with us now. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Richard Chuba is a pollster. He's founder of the Glenn Gariff Group and former Republican operative. He's got new numbers out about the acceptance in Michigan of adding protections to the LGBT community. Hey, Rich.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks so much, you two. So, Frank, first I want to just dig into this because you made waves when you decided to introduce this legislation 5 years ago. Why did you decide to buck the conservative trend and argue in favor of equal rights?
Yeah, well, I think it was more I was unaware that there was a loophole in the law, a loophole as I would consider it. Actually, it was a bill that was being drafted by a colleague from Ann Arbor, Jeff Irwin, and he came up and said, listen, I am a progressive Democrat. It's a Republican-controlled state right now. The only way to get this done is to have a Republican do it. And so he explained the issue to me, and it seemed, I guess I didn't run the political traps on it right away. It just seemed like the right thing to do at the time, and I didn't think it would be terribly tough to explain to the average voter that, do you think it's right, but, you know, regardless of religious affiliation or how you feel about these types of issues, don't you at least think that these are some basic protections that the state ought to offer?
Jeff Irwin, state senator of Ann Arbor right now, he is progressive. Why do you think he chose you?
We have a great relationship. His dad was the former state senator, Mitch Irwin. Of our district. So I talked to Mitch when I was running for office up there because he was also a young guy when he got elected. And Jeff and I just kind of, you know, we spent a lot of time on the House floor getting to know members. Him and I just clicked. And I think he probably picked me just because I was a younger Republican. And agreed with him on the issue.
Frank, you lost your primary to one actually Lee Chatfield, who just so happens to be the Republican Speaker of the House this year.
Yes, yep.
Was it because of this issue?
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, I think the Speaker was, or this now Speaker was going to run regardless. So I'm not sure if this issue pushed up that time frame or not. You know, the speaker and I are actually very good friends. We were friends before we ran against each other. We're even better friends now, actually. I think he'd agree with that. So, you know, I'm not sure if this pushed up his timeline. You know, he's a bit more conservative than me on some issues. And so if you asked him, it might have been a multitude of issues why he ran.
Rich, let's cut to 5 years later, present day. You've got new numbers out. Where do Michigan voters stand on the issue of adding protections to the state constitution for the LGBT community?
Well, you know, the numbers aren't that different from what they have been. They've just grown more intense. And that is 79% support adding LGBT community to Elliot Larson in Michigan. And that's a couple of points higher than we've seen in the past. But, you know, what's really staggering is the intensity of that vote, where two-thirds of the voters now strongly support it. And that's where we're really seeing some shifts here. You know, Frank mentioned earlier that, you know, he one of the reasons he introduced this legislation was because he was surprised by this loophole. And one of the questions we asked was, is it legal or illegal in Michigan to fire somebody if you find out they're gay? And 81% of the voters already think it's illegal. So I think one of the problems is people just don't know that this is, it's perfectly legal right to fire somebody.
I totally agree with that. Now, I'd like to ask Rich a question too after this, but you know, when I, as we, the campaign moved forward that year, I was able to, I think, educate voters, and they were surprised that we weren't talking even about gay marriage. So when the issues came up, people were like, well, I'm opposed or I support gay marriage. I said, wait, we're not even talking about that. When you explain that these are just basic protections, that, you know, you kind of saw their face change, like, oh yeah, well, that's okay with me.
Oh, interesting. And Frank, you want to ask Rich a question. So go over, take over my interview duties.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any regional breakdown, because you know, one of the polls that I had seen that it varied greatly in Michigan when you asked that question. And so even during our campaign, we saw cross tabs of middle of the road voters and how they felt. And, you know, geographically, that those response rates were very different.
Well, you know, we did break it down geographically, but one of the things we look at here, and I think, Frank, you experienced it more than anybody out there, is who are these people who oppose? And one of the things we find is they are essentially older, white, outstate Republicans. They are over 65. They are primary voters. And they're watching Fox News. And they, as we know, in a primary, you know, only about 8% of the overall electorate votes in a Republican primary when they roll around in August. And they really do have a disproportionate share of control over this issue in the state right now.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And I'm probably evidence of that with my primary. And this being in one of the issues. So, you know, one of the things I might add to that is it may be a Fox viewer, but when I ran across of people that when I explained it and they still didn't agree with me, was it was more of a libertarian approach. They didn't believe in the civil rights issues regardless. They thought, I want government hands off. If I want to fire someone, that's my choice. If I want to kick someone out of my rental property, that's my choice. So I kind of ran into it from the very far right libertarian approach, where I don't care about religion, I don't care about any of these other protected classes, just stay out of my way.
Interesting. So then, Rich, working in Republican politics, do you think this is an issue then of plain and simple messaging about the issue? If 79% of people support the expansion and yet it continues to not happen, what is getting lost?
Well, I think, again, this goes back to who actually votes in early August in primaries, specifically who votes in Republican primaries. And it is clearly older voters, significantly older. Younger Republicans, this does not faze them. You know, we also ask this question of religious freedom, which is becoming a big part of this conversation. Should an employer be able to fire somebody they find out as LGBT if it violates their own personal religious beliefs? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And over 80% of voters, in fact, 83% of voters say no. But when you look at who are those 8% who said yes, it is essentially 1 in 4 Republicans.
Sure. And highly motivated, right? The other problem I think this issue has, even though it's widely supported along the electorate, is it's not a powerful motivator, right? So it's not a tier one issue for people that support it. Now, those 1 in 4 that are coming out in a primary, if it is an issue that the candidates are talking about, they're probably very motivated. The small group is probably very motivated to defeat it. But I don't think that 80% of people that supports this issue is coming out to vote for Elliot Larson's adoption of this based on anything else. Right. So they're probably worried about infrastructure, education. That's what's motivating them. And this issue can't really catch fire before that.
I think where it can motivate, or it does motivate, is in general elections, particularly amongst voters under 40.
Mm.
Those are the voters who this really, they're like, hold it. This is a matter of fairness.
Right.
It's a matter of what are our morals? What are the values we have? And for those voters under 40, it matters. So, if you come out of a primary staunchly opposed to this in a swing district, it could cost you votes with voters under 40.
Right. And it's the issue can even be spliced a little bit more. And I think that the other side will use the extreme examples to oppose it. But, I ran across different issues of people that just didn't understand the transgender community, and that scared them enough away not to get involved. They didn't understand necessarily what sexual identification was, and so that scared them enough not to come out and support the whole of it. So, they would say, "Well, I know what gay is. I have a gay cousin, or my brother's gay. I know what that is, and that's fine with me. But I don't know enough about this, and that scares me."
It appears Governor Gretchen Whitmer has said she wants an expansion, but it appears that the legislature, with two Republican majorities in both chambers, are not willing to approve that. Frank Foster, you said you are friends with Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. What would you say to him right now about bringing up this expansion?
Well, ultimately he's got, again, I'll come back to what I said. He's got to fix roads. He's got to balance a budget. Majority of the citizenry cares about those two things above this. So I don't think he's in a position that he's going to take it up either based on philosophical beliefs or based on the fact that he's got things that he would deem more important in front of him that he needs to get done for the state. So I probably wouldn't bring it up, though, because I wouldn't want to sour a friendship.
Frank Foster, former Republican legislator from up north, and Richard Shuba, founder of the polling firm Glenn Gariff Group. Hey, guys, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Zoe. And Rich, nice to talk with you.
Great to talk with you. Good to be here.
It is like going to the movies for your ears. That's the motto of Radio Campfire, a listening event series featured at this year's Detroit Podcast Festival. It happens tomorrow at Music Town in Detroit. Juliet Heinle and Brenna York are the co-hosts of Radio Campfire. They are here in the studio to fill us in on some of the best audio coming out of Detroit. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so first, I guess I just have to ask, when I think of listening to podcasts, you see that image of like folks exercising or running with headphones in or being on, a train with your earbuds. You are kind of like throwing that system overboard and going, let's listen to podcasts together. Why?
Yeah, exactly. Thinking about it, like filmmakers have screenings and authors have readings and bands play concerts, and like there's totally room for audio work to have that same kind of community atmosphere of enjoying this work.
Definitely. And so essentially we get the chance to also put in a bunch of pieces that we're excited about, come up with a theme first, and then build out with pieces that we're excited about.
Right. It's this sort of curated podcast. So let's talk a little bit about some of those pieces that you've chosen. Let's take a listen first to a clip from Detroit History Podcast.
The exact number of Detroiters who jammed the East Side Riverfront to witness the life and death spectacle is lost to history. But the throng blanketed every available space and throbbed with anticipation. Houdini calmly looked up at the noontime sky, then just as coolly jumped off the Belle Isle Bridge into the frigid, turbulent Detroit River below.
So what's going on here?
Yeah, so what's going on here is what Detroit History Podcast does a lot of, which is like using archival audio and kind of reimagining historical occurrences in and around Detroit to kind of do these time travel stories about specific events in Detroit history. And the one we just heard was about Harry Houdini. Yeah. So,
which a lot of people don't know his ties to Detroit. The fact that he jumped off the Belle Isle Bridge, but also ended up dying in Detroit a few years later on Halloween.
Right. Indeed, it's a really interesting story about Harry Houdini and Detroit. And who is making that podcast?
Tim Kiska is the host and producer of that show. And he actually makes it with his son, Eric Kiska. So it's a family produced show. And yeah, Tim Kiska is like a longtime Detroit Free Press journalist. And also he's a history professor at University of Michigan Dearborn. And you can just tell that he loves what he's talking about.
Love it. Okay, next, let's close our eyes and listen. I guess unless, of course, you're driving or something like that. Let's listen to this clip from Homemade Stories.
I'm headed into Little Willie's hair salon on Grand River, and I'm feeling like a kid again. Some kids would go to the hair salon with their mom. However, I used to go to the hair salon with my dad. His name is Billy Badass Kaysen. He's bald like me, so he wasn't getting his hair did. We would drive around the city selling ads for his Hair Designer magazine. In fact, he was the first person who started calling people who did hair designers.
They was called beauticians or coiffures. So I came up with the word. First, it was Detroit Black Hair Designers. Then I started cutting it down till I got to the point that it was hair designers. And it's been hair designers for the last 30 years.
Brenna, who's behind this podcast?
So this is Shannon Kaysen, and he is a storyteller from Detroit. And this podcast is his homespun stories. He talks about things in his life, but it also is really centered in Detroit. And he talks about growing up there, his life there now. He was in Chicago for a little while, so a lot of it is about him coming back. And he's just a really compelling speaker. And he's actually having an event right after ours, a live taping of Homemade Stories right after our event on Friday.
Okay, let's jump into, finally, we've got Shattered from WDIV and Graham Media. This season focuses on who else? White boy Rick. And he was an informant, of course, turned into a cocaine dealer. Let's take a listen.
In 1987, when Wershey was arrested for allegedly possessing 8 kilos of cocaine.
If you ask people about Rick Wershey, they don't know Rick Wershey. But if you say white boy Rick, people act like they know who I am and they don't know me.
Juliet, why this podcast?
I think that White Boy Rick is an example of one of those podcasts that takes a story that you know the ending of from the beginning. You already know what happens. And it unravels all the layers, but also continues to show you, like, through lots of different voices, how complex the story really is. And it just keeps turning and turning and turning, which I think is what podcasts are really good for, which is getting into a long story.
So you're having this event in Detroit tomorrow. Where is podcasting right now in Detroit? What does that look like? Because it feels like there's this really big push and a lot of activity around podcasting in the city.
Well, we're really taking this as an opportunity to get to know what's happening in Detroit beyond our circle. I mean, two of the clips we played for you today, Zach Rosen, who's a part of Radio Campfire, worked on White Boy Rick, Shannon Kaysen in Homemade Stories. So we have learned through them and through doing Radio Campfire a little bit of what's happening, but we're looking to get a lot of exposure this weekend of what else is happening in Detroit, because these are the ones that we know really well.
there are a lot of podcasting studios around Detroit, some that you can, you know, go in and rent and record your own work, or there are neighborhood studios that are popping up. There's one called Motor City Women, which is like a women's run podcasting studio. So there's a lot of stuff being made there, and I'm so excited for this festival where it's all going to be featured.
The Radio Campfire Listening Event Series at this year's Detroit Podcast Festival happens tomorrow at Music Town in Detroit. Brenny York and Juliet Heinle, who we should say worked on Michigan Radio's podcast Believed. It's been wonderful to have you both here as the co-hosts of Radio Campfire. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Zoe. Thanks a lot.
And that is the show for today, a busy Thursday summer day. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty.